Hello and welcome to Four Corners, a closer look at one of the stories shaping your world. I'm Shahab Mossavat at Press TV Centre in Tehran. The visit by the IAEA's Director of Safeguard Operations would not usually create much of a stir. But given the situation of Iran's nuclear dossier and recent developments, most notably last week's national intelligence estimates delivered by the United States Congress, the presence of Hermann Neckerts and his team takes on much added significance. They will address outstanding issues, first identified in the framework document signed between the agency and Iran in August. Among topics to be discussed is the provenance of the unsourced nuclear contamination found at one of Iran's technical universities. The talks began on Monday, and Iran's representatives at the talks, Ali Asghar Soltaniyeh, says the talks are expected to continue until Wednesday. So, what is the state of play? What effect will this latest IAEA visit have? And have the prospects of further sanctions receded or grown? On Four Corners are Dr. David McMichael, who is a former analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA. He is a longtime critic of the agency, citing its politicization as its greatest failure. Adam Pittman. Mr. Pittman is a spokesperson for BASIC, the British American Security Information Council, which is an independent research organization that analyzes international security issues. Analysis and updates on all key international nuclear-related events is their main. Kevin Sanders, formerly science editor with CNN, Mr. Sanders is director of special projects at the War and Peace Foundation in New York, from where he joins us. And Dr. Owen Green. Dr. Green is a senior lecturer in international relations and strategic studies. He is also a prolific writer and is in great demand as a policy advisor. If I can begin with you, Mr. Sanders. Are you there, Mr. Sanders?
I am.
Welcome to Four Corners once again. How much does it matter what the IAEA has to say now in the aftermath of last week's National Intelligence Estimates report?
Well, in a broad sense, what the IAEA does now has assumed increasing importance because if the world is on the edge of what is romantically called the nuclear renaissance, then more and more nations, one way or another, are going to be involved in the nuclear fuel cycle. And so the issues for the security of the world at large are heightened and the dangers are much, much greater because it becomes essential at that point, indeed it is essential now, that the entire nuclear fuel cycle be brought under the most rigid, international, intrusive inspection and verification. And it is in that broader context that what's going on in Iran now assumes very great importance. And there is a real need for consistency. I think that the people of the world, and particularly those people who are not involved in the nuclear arms race or do not have nuclear power, have a particularly urgent right to demand that those nations which do have nuclear weapons get rid of them, those nations which are going to have or do have nuclear power make themselves available to the most stringent safety inspections. So if in fact the IAEA wants to make the most stringent possible example of Iran, fine, but they have to do that to every other nation that has or will have nuclear power.
David McMichael, how justified is Washington in not trusting the Iranians?
I find it difficult to understand the basis on which the United States, Washington, if you will, mistrusts Iran. The historical record going back, of course, to 1953, I would say, rather overt support which the United States gave to Iraq at the time of its invasion of Iran, and the maintenance of very hard sanctions by the United States over the years, arguably says the United States mistrusts Iran, but on the historical record, it is difficult to see what, aside from the sensational event of 1979 and the so-called hostage crisis, what Iran has done either regionally or internationally to cause this amount of suspicion, distrust, and I would say animosity by the United States.
Adam Pittman, Iran, to be trusted?
Is it trusted?
Is it trustworthy?
I don't think that it's been as proactive in its commitment to the IAEA's initiatives. I think the recent NIE report gives Iran a very good opportunity to come forward and be as forthcoming in what they do know about their program, because the U.S. has laid it all out on the table. They've been very honest about what they do know. Now it's a good opportunity for Iran to come forward and say and clear up some of the outstanding matters
Mr. Pittman, amongst all the qualifications and prevarications, what the United States did say very clearly was that Iran had not had a weapons program since at least 2003. And that ran completely in a countervailing direction to the report that the CIA, one of the contributors to the NIE, produced in 2005, which clearly said Iran is actively seeking nuclear weapons.
But, you know, these things are true. But at the same time, I think it's important to remember that that the report also found that it felt as if economic and military pressure was something that was working or something that would be able to work in the future. And so I think that these are all positive regarding halting the nuclear program. This was a positive finding. Iran can now come ahead and commit itself to the diplomatic initiatives and get some momentum behind verifying to the world that its program is not designed for nuclear weaponry, that in fact is being used for only civil purposes.
Owen Green, senior lecturer in international studies and strategic studies, international relations and strategic studies, on the line. What do you make of the fact that Mohammed El-Baradei isn't on this trip to Iran, that he sent a technical team? Does that strategically indicate a change in approach and a different place on the path to giving Iran a clean bill of health?
Much into that. I mean, I think the key point here is that this is a technical mission to try and clarify various points, and I'm sure Mr. El-Baradei will be following up with the technical findings. I don't suspect, I'm afraid, that this mission will entirely clarify everything. There's bound to be a series of meetings. That's just in the nature of these things. And so I must admit that I very much doubt, unfortunately, that this issue is coming to closure as far as the IAEA's relationship with Iran. But I certainly hope that all technical issues are resolved relatively soon. Let's try and distinguish three different factors that are of concern here. One is whether or not, and this is of course intelligence work, IAEA has no specific evidence on this, whether or not there was actively work on nuclear warhead and weapon design. And as you say, the NEA, the US intelligence says that work seems to have ceased for at least a couple of years. The second is, is there large-scale uranium enrichment processes, which is obviously a major international source of concern. And thirdly, there's the problems of, there has been, unfortunately, in the early 2000s, a period in which Iran did not report accurately to the IAEA, which stimulated this whole problem, because it was only through exposure that activities that hadn't been reported to the IAEA were revealed. And this is that's the area which the IAEA is seeking to sort out, and I very much hope that dimension is sorted out fairly soon.
But Dr. Green, the United States passed punitive legislation as long ago as 1998, so in essence preempting a crisis which it set about to bring about. In passing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Iran Act in 1998, it estimated that Iran was on that path at that time, and yet it's never actually brought forward any evidence or any intelligence to that effect, has it?
Yes, I mean, I think it's fairly clear that Iran has had relatively advanced relevant nuclear research, let's put it that way, in terms of enrichment. The main technical barriers to building a weapon are to do with the production of weapons-grade fissile material. And, I mean, I think not only Iran, but there are many sources of concern to do with that, and it's the IAEA's job not only to perform technical safeguards, but to actually play a sort of relatively proactive role for raising concerns. I agree with you completely. I certainly don't want to speak on behalf of the United States here. I think, unfortunately, U.S. and Iranian dialogue and positions have been, you know, there have been bad mistakes from both sides, and certainly from the U.S. side, that includes. I think it would be much more constructive if there was a more constructive relationship between the two. So I support that, but that is not to say that there aren't legitimate concerns, particularly when it was revealed that there was a lot of unreported activity, nuclear activity, that was discovered by the IAEA through various means, which is now the issue that's sort of, in a sense, stimulated a lot of these investigations. And I do hope now that all of that can be cleared up. There'll still be the uranium enrichment program, which is really a question of confidence, as you said.
Mr. McMichael, according to the UN Charter, preemption is qualified as an act of aggression unless it's ordered under Articles 40 onwards of Chapter 7 of the Charter. Now, Iran has been brought to book and has been sanctioned exactly under those terms, and yet there is no evidence whatsoever that has been made available to qualify those sanctions. And now there's talk of China wanting to take back those sanctions. Do you think there's any danger that there will be a third set of sanctions? And if there are going to be a third set of sanctions against Iran, what is the justification for that?
Well, yes, there is a danger, if you want to express it that way, that there will be a third set of sanctions. The United States is now engaging in furious conversations with both Russia and China to get them to agree to some sort of new sanctions. Both of these countries are reluctant to do so, and on the ground which you just described, that the evidence which would justify the application of these sorts of sanctions is, to say the least, weak and ambiguous. But yes, there is a danger, and this would, and I think you noted this in your opening remarks, that the crisis over this, over the last decade or so, has been, to a great extent, in my opinion, a false crisis. I will say, and I want to address this point on the unreported activities, and we can deduce this not only from the statements made on the key judgments of the that have been released in this new National Intelligence Estimates, but comments made about the sources and methods of this, that the conviction that there was a previous military program was based essentially on intercepts of telephone conversations between military officers who were discussing the fact that the program had been shut down. And I think I can assure you from some knowledge of this sort of thing that practically every country in the world of any reasonable size and ambition has had its military conducting covert, if you will, or classified research into the question of acquiring nuclear weapons. Is
Kevin,
it advisable for us to do so? Do we have the capability to use them, the delivery means, and so forth? And these studies are classified.
Kevin
we do
Saunders.
Them all the time. We
Kevin
have
Saunders.
A program
Kevin.
Going right now for increasing our nuclear readiness, so to speak. So I'm quite convinced that that sort of thing went on. The question is, did that sort of internal study, and I believe it never went further than study, consist of a violation of Iran's obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty?
Kevin Saunders, I'm sure you know the terms of the Nonproliferation Treaty much better than I do. Please disabuse us of any misunderstanding that we may have. Is it not the case that research is okay, development is not? Reading an article, reading someone else's research, someone else's notes, is acceptable, there is no disclosure required, but actually going ahead and taking the steps to follow the outline thereof is a problem.
Well, there is a dreadful clause, Clause 4, which says that all nations, no matter what else the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty says, all nations have a, quote, inalienable right to develop nuclear energy. And as a result, we have a situation that has arisen now where very, very soon a lot more nations are going to be able to seize on that to go ahead and develop nuclear power. Now, I say that as one who regrets that nuclear power ever came about. I regret that the nuclear bomb was ever developed. But since it has, I think that it is particularly important that nuclear power, nuclear energy, and all of the mechanics and information that makes that possible be under the strictest control. It's important to notice that it is not necessary to have highly enriched uranium to have a nuclear reactor. It makes it easier in some ways, but it's not necessary. And so any nation that has or is developing enriched uranium should be viewed with great concern.
But Mr.
And
Saunders,
that would, of course, include
with
the United
respect,
States, which,
Mr.
Has,
Mr.
which
Saunders,
has tons of the material.
Mr. Saunders, with respect, the samples that the IAEA have retrieved from Iranian sites have been enriched to 3.6%. Not the 90% weapons grade that right. It needs to be in order to be planted onto the uranium or plutonium hemispheres at their head of warheads. So there is no evidence at the moment to justify these sanctions, it would seem. The question I wanted to put to you, sir, is are there really parallel technologies which can be used equally peacefully as well as for armaments? And is it the case that those parallel technologies are being cited mischievously rather than for the purposes which Iran claims they're being put?
Well, I'm sure that they'll be seized upon highly selectively, quite hypocritically, quite arbitrarily, for political purposes. I mean, this has been the case all along. For example, as far as enriched uranium is concerned, countries like Brazil and Japan and South Africa are developing highly enriched uranium, and they are not necessarily developing it to the point of nuclear weapons, but the equipment and the knowledge,
very
the information,
good. Adam
the
Pittman,
materials
I wanted to come
are
to
there,
you, unfortunately.
And it can be a political decision to direct it in that way.
Very good, sir. Adam Pittman, I did want to come to you. Time has beaten us for the news. I'll come to you directly after the news, if you just hold your thoughts, okay? As I said, a break for the news headlines in brief. And when we return, how close is the end of Iran's nuclear controversy? And what sort of a timetable might be expected for the withdrawal of current sanctions? Please stay with us on Press TV. Welcome back to Four Corners. Last week's national intelligence estimate, ordered by Democrat Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, seems to have absolved Iran of the principal faults upon which sanctions were first proposed and imposed by the United Nations Security Council. Calls that these ought to be reviewed and that further sanctions suspended indefinitely have come from a number of quarters. Late last week, a commission of European parliamentarians became the latest to add their voice to demands that the sanctions regime be reviewed. China, Russia, and a host of prominent Democrats in the United States have made similar demands. However, there is still a political minority, particularly in the United States and Israel, who portray sanctions as having been effective and who are demanding further punitive measures against Iran. So what are the prospects for diplomacy, and how equitable will further talks be? Joining me on Four Corners once more are Adam Pittman in London, Dr. David McMichael in Washington, Kevin Saunders in New York, and Dr. Owen Green, who joins us on the line. If I can start with you, Mr. Pittman, why should Iran want to engage with the West? After all, it's been saying for a long time it's only interested in nuclear energy and been accused of being a liar in the crudest terms.
I don't know if it's been accused of being a liar per se. I would say that it is within Iran's interest to cooperate with the international community because it opens up a number of opportunities in the long term. Now, it could continue in the route that it's on now and say that it would not like to cooperate fully with the international community, but would rather just participate with the IAEA. But I think that a commitment to the international community or a commitment to Russian or Chinese interests would be a significant step forward to demonstrate to the international community that Iran's nuclear program is in fact just for civilian interests and that it has nothing to hide.
But would
it be, that would go along.
But Mr. Pittman, would that not be a blow to the interests of the United States and the West as a whole, given that they put such a store by the Middle East being a very, very significant area and sphere of influence for them?
Well, you know, I don't think it would be a blow because everybody here is just trying to confirm that Iran's nuclear program is not being weaponized. And so I think that it would be a win for the U.S. and for Europe and for the world and for Iran if Iran were to come forward and demonstrate that its program is very transparently not being used for weapon technology.
Owen Green, you said earlier on that you thought that resolution to the crisis was still a long way off. I mean, Japan's case took almost 20 years to resolve, and Japan has never been accused of having any interest in nuclear weapons. Its civilian nuclear program took 20 years to scrutinize before it was given a clean bill of health. You said that you think Iran's is also a long way from being resolved. But let's just take an example. Take, for instance, the fact that that the IAEA comes to the conclusion that Iran is solely interested in civilian nuclear energy and that that has to be scrutinized, kept a lid on, it has to be examined every so often. What do you think the response of the 5+1 group, that's the permanent five members of the United Nations and Germany, is going to be in that instance?
I think everything will depend upon what is decided to do with the large-scale uranium enrichment processes that are going on in Iran. Everything else is important, but that is the critical thing. And it's critical not because the uranium enrichment program necessarily demonstrates that Iran has nuclear weapon intentions, but that it's a major, major source of concern, much more than any other areas. So I feel that there is quite an easy agreement to be had between, as you say, the P5+1 and Iran and others. If an arrangement is come which essentially leads to the suspension of the large-scale uranium enrichment. Of course, then there are a whole range of Iranian concerns about security of supply of its uranium for its nuclear power program, but I think those are technical issues that can be sorted. And so when I said it's a long-term process, I suppose I have in mind that I rather doubt that there hasn't been easy signs to show that there is a willingness on the part of the Iranian government to suspend the uranium enrichment, and there's not a great deal of...
But Dr. Green...
And if it doesn't, then... excuse me for one second. And if it doesn't, I think the suspicions of at least those P5+1 will continue.
Certainly, Dr. Green. But the point I wanted to make was that the suspension was a voluntary suspension on the part of Iran.
Yes.
Iran wasn't compelled to suspend its enrichment program whatsoever, but decided to do that in 2004 of its own accord. It did that. It continued that regime for a period of time in which it and the EU3, that's Britain, France and Germany, negotiated.
Yeah.
When it felt that that wasn't going anywhere, it said, again, that we're withdrawing our voluntary action. Why is it being punished for an action that it took as an act of goodwill?
Well, I mean, I think the realities here are that that there is a serious and legitimate concern, not only to do with Iran, but any country which appears to not only have, a large-scale program that could build its, could greatly enhance its capacity to build weapons, but in some sense where there's an underlying suspicion about at least where some sections of the government might want to take it. And so there is a wider confidence-building process here. And I would simply say to Iran, I mean, you're quite right that it was a voluntary action in the sense of the NPT, although obviously UN Security Council resolutions aren't voluntary. But
they followed, didn't they, sir?
Sorry?
They followed later.
Yes, and so now we have a UN Security Council resolution, and that's not voluntary.
No, but they followed as a punitive reaction to the fact that Iran decided to withdraw its voluntary action. There was,
exactly.
Prior to that, there was no UN resolution pending against Iran whatsoever.
I take your point entirely, but I think the main framework is, maybe I slightly disagree with the framework that you place on this. If this is going to be resolved, then it's not only going to be resolved through legal technicalities. It boils down to a basic thing, that there is suspicion among some major countries, maybe wrong, about the intentions of the Iranian government. And in that context, that will only be resolved if some way can be found that meets Iran's legitimate expectations to have a nuclear power program, and to have some security of supply of the relevant level of enriched uranium, and at the same time reassures others, including the permanent members of the Security Council and others, that this isn't leading to a capacity where a nuclear weapons program could emerge very rapidly.
Certainly. David McMichael, an exchange of views, a dialogue between nations. I talked about the fact that Iran feels that there is a lack of trust at the beginning of this introduction when I turned to Mr. Pittman, and I asked, why should Iran want to negotiate? Is it in Iran's interest to negotiate with the IAEA, with the United Nations Security Council? Are they bodies that act with an even-handedness?
Well, the last part of your question is very important. Do they operate even-handedly? As you recall, American Defense Secretary Gates, addressing the Gulf nations in Bahrain the other day, was challenged from the audience about the fact that the United States does not act even-handedly in the Middle East. It supports consistently the position of one country there, which I will not name. The other aspect in part of this discussion going on were these constant references to Iran dealing with the quote-unquote international community. Now, how does one define the international community? Is it simply Western Europe and the United States, or is it the nations represented in the United Nations altogether? The representative of that view of the international community is, in fact, the IAEA on this question with which we're dealing. And I don't think, Mohammed al-Bardi, the head of the IAEA, has declared over and over again through this decade, yes, that Iran has been cooperating, has been acting at least within the letter of the law. He says, I have some suspicions which haven't been quite resolved yet, but by and large, Iran has dealt with the international community. We know that Iran came forward many times in 2003, particularly, offering to deal openly with the United States, particularly on all questions of concern. The United States rebuked its representative through the Swiss embassy in Tehran for even forwarding such a request. So I regard this question being raised as, will Iran deal honestly, forthrightly with the international community? As an American, and believe me, as somebody who has sat under a nuclear weapons explosion in the past and been a custodian while in the service of nuclear weapons, I can tell you, if I've got to trust anybody over the record of the past few years, just right now, the Middle East and so forth, if I'm going to trust anyone in this, I'm sorry to say this as an American citizen, but my trust goes far more to the representatives of Tehran than they do to the current representatives from Washington, D.C.
Thank you for that. Kevin Sanders, Mr. Neckerts is in Tehran. I think it's a significant presence because he is a technical man. He has come to sort out the technical issues. There are a few of the technical issues which, according to the reports by Mr. al-Baradei last month, have been resolved. Some huge issues to do with uranium hemispheres, to do with the P1 and P2 centrifuges. They say that contamination issues at one of Iran's technical universities is one of the outstanding issues. Are you aware of what other outstanding issues are still at stake?
No, but that's what they're there to investigate, and that's what the IAEA is for. That is its most essential duty. And given the political landscape now, which is going quite dramatically changed with the recent intelligence report from the United States, in a way, Iran is now in a peculiar position where it could bring about a kind of jujitsu in which, if Iran were to say, not only do we allow your inspections, not only do we encourage them, but we insist on them. And we insist that these inspections to verify complete compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty be observed universally and equally with all nations, and to turn the searchlight of disapproval on those nations which then decline. And that would include certainly the United States, which has, for example, from the very beginning of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which requires that those nations which have nuclear weapons get rid of them, has gone ahead and built and built and built these huge nuclear arsenals, and only now they're being brought down, even while the United States is talking about developing new nuclear weapons, using nuclear weapons, and so on. So the simple solution to all of these problems is that all nations be required to observe punctiliously the terms of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And given that the United States has lost so much moral authority, first with the claim of Iraq's nuclear weapons, then its claims about Iran now rejected, that the United States is no longer in a position to argue against this. The moral authority, in a peculiar way, has shifted to Iran if Iran wanted to seize upon it and say, yes, inspect us and inspect everyone else equally, and make a big fuss about that.
Adam Pittman, as someone who tries to build bilateral relationships, how concerned are you that that the Non-Proliferation Treaty has been so undermined by this process, the process of North Korea, Libya, South Africa, the fact that Israel is not a signatory, India is not a signatory? How undermined has it and, in fact, the due process of international law been by the fact that so many of the tenets of this agreement and many other agreements have been ridden over so roughshod over the past years?
I guess I tend to look at the cup half full, sort of. I'm sort of that person. I think that one thing that allows you to be optimistic is that there's been a number of bilateral discussions between the U.S. government and India, or the Chinese and North Korea, and the U.S. and China, and so on and so forth, the EU with Iran. These are all things that hopefully will in the long term build a stronger NPT regime. There's a lot of things that need to be worked out right now. And in the post-Cold War era, there's been a number of question marks that have risen. But I think when we think about it long term, these sort of bilateral discussions that aren't necessarily multilateral at this point will in the future build a better NPT regime.
Kevin Saunders, I just want to turn back to you. I want to ask you a technical question. Iran says it's got about 3,000 centrifuges, and estimates by other scientists I've spoken to is that if they were working at full capacity, spinning as fast as they can, I think it's about 10,000 hemicycles per minute, if they were going around at that speed the whole year, they could produce about enough enriched plutonium or uranium for two weapons. Now that's verifiable, isn't it? If you can verify that that's the amount accurately that these centrifuges can produce, if they're not being used in the process of energy production, if there's any lack of megawatts being produced by that nuclear power station in Bushehr, surely that is something that can be verified.
It can be measured and verified and observed and put under scrutiny at all times, yes. That is really not the problem. And it's interesting that you bring up those figures, because they're worth bearing in mind that the nations which are so appalled by these developments in Iran, that is the capacity conceivably to produce one or two weapons over time, are nations that themselves, in the case of the United States and Russia collectively, have more than 20,000 nuclear weapons, 20,000. And each of those nations has 2,000 of those weapons on head trigger alert. So surely the sheer scale of it is absurd.
Owen Green, go ahead.
Yes, I mean, I think you can, coming back to your technical question, I mean, but before doing that, I agree with the point that Kevin Saunders is making, that it's important also to look to nuclear disarmament of nuclear weapon states. But obviously the NPT here accepts that in a transitional phase, which hopefully is transitional, we also have to prevent the addition of new nuclear weapon states. Now, on that context, I think your question is a very good one. Now, it is possible to verify the amounts of uranium coming from well-specified sites if they're well-monitored. I suppose the big problem is simply the sheer scale. If there's a large-scale uranium enrichment program going on, a failure of control for a few months, or a decision by a government to simply withdraw or disallow inspectors for a year or two could make a big strategic difference. And therefore, the scale of the uranium enrichment facility is a big factor. If it could be, I think, one of the most productive areas of negotiation between the P5 plus one and Iran would now be to look at ways of not only improving verification of that uranium enrichment centrifuge center, but also finding some way of slowing down the scale so that any worrying activities that may or may not start to happen wouldn't culminate in major strategic differences in only a year, but maybe take longer.
Dr. Green, how workable would the proposal, one of the proposals that Mohammed El-Baradei has put forward, for a pause rather than a suspension or a continuation of the enrichment? He's called for a pause, and what that seems to entail is that the centrifuges continue to spin, because if they were to be stopped, a lot of the material that has been gained through them would be lost, or all of it would be lost, in fact. But what a pause would mean is that the centrifuges continue to spin, but none of the uranium hexafluoride gas, which is required for enrichment, is added. How workable is that proposal, and how likely do you think it would be both acceptable to the Iranians and acceptable as some sort of halfway house to the West and to the powers that are asking Iran to suspend?
I think it would be quite practical, but only for a short time, because it would raise the question, you know, it's not the sort of thing that could be sustainable for months, I think. So it would be then a question of what would be the direction of travel after that. I mean, in a sense, we're at a phase now where symbolic acts such as a pause, I think, would have very important symbolic and political implications. It would clarify that there was, you know, a real interest on all sides to resolve the issue. But I don't think you could, it would then have to be followed up with some practical steps on both sides that led to, you know, what Iran's security in having enriched uranium. You must remember that, as I understand it, the enrichment levels the reactors that Iran is seeking to fuel are relatively low enriched uranium. It's not anywhere near weapons grade. And so, provided we can find a way of ensuring the supply to your nuclear power program, which, as I say, reduces the sort of routine enrichment capacity of these spinning centrifuges, that's where we need to head. But to come back to your central question, I think a pause would be an important step, but it wouldn't be sustainable for long. Something else would have to follow.
I see. David McMichael, we're in a politically dicey situation. The NIE comes out last week, says that Iran hasn't been carrying out these activities. What do you think the political fallout from that is going to be? What are the consequences that we're going to see? Harry Reid said that he thought that it was useful in preventing an almost unpreventable war. He saw that there was this process of war making going on that was in parallel to what had happened in Iraq. Do you think that that war making process has now receded, being put on the back burner, and do you think that it has prevented perhaps further sanctions? Do you think that the process of diplomacy in a positive direction has been given a boost?
Well, there's a lot in that question. Certainly the political fallout in a limited sense has already begun, particularly in the United States, with screams and howls coming from certainly the predictable sources associated, let us say, with the Vice President Cheney's office, and the former United States Ambassador to the United Nations, Mr. Bolton, widely known as Bonkers Bolton, and others who claim betrayal. Here is this national intelligence estimate, which reverses itself, reverses the charges made in the unreleased national intelligence estimate of 2005, which concluded at that time that Iran was vigorously pursuing and about to achieve nuclear weapons status. And
you're talking about the report by John Poindexter,
as my colleague Ray McGovern says, a declaration of independence by the intelligence community. I read this document, and I've read it very carefully. I have the key judgments in front of me here. It is one of the most ambiguous documents that I have ever seen. It's very curious. It tries to look at things both ways. Iran isn't, but they were. And they aren't, but they might. You know, it's sloppy in terms of, I've helped draft national intelligence estimates in the past, and this is not exactly a gem in this. It raises far more questions, at least questions that can be argued politically, than it resolves. The one thing it does do, however, is to declare that Iran does, this is unambiguous, does not now have an ongoing nuclear weapons program. The declaration that they did have one in the past produced screams from Mr. Jalili, who is the technical expert on this in the Iranian parliament, who says this is in fact another lie, because we never did have a program, except in the sense, as I discussed before. I am quite certain, just as Brazil, which one of you, the fellow panelists mentioned,
thank you, Mr. Michael.
Is currently doing, as other nations
are currently
doing.
I need to cut you short because we're running out of time.
Within the military,
I need to cut you short, Mr. McMichael. We are running out of time. I just want to give the last word to Adam Pittman.
Doing this.
Adam,
what are
Pittman,
the costs? What are the
you're
consequences?
You're the man with your glass half full.
This is the type of staff study that goes
with your glass half full. Should we now be looking forward to a better set of relationships going on, given that the NIE, should we take a positive look at the NIE, and should we be enthused by the fact that it was Harry Reid, a very prominent politician, a seasoned politician, and a sanguine man, who's put his name behind it?
Well, Harry Reid has lost a lot of credibility recently. I would turn and look at what the Democratic presidential candidates are saying these days on an assessment of the NIE in America.
It's not
necessarily positive, but I do hope that in the following weeks that we are able to have more dialogue between the two countries.
Thank you for that.
Yeah.
And that was Four Corners. I'd like to thank my guests, Adam Pittman in London, David McMichael, Kevin Sanders, and Owen Green, who joined us by telephone, and of course you for watching. We welcome your thoughts, comments, and suggestions. Please send them to us on fourcorners@presstv.ir. I've been your host, Shahab Mossavat, from Tehran. Goodbye.